Welcome again to our series on how the Bible came to us. We are getting down close to the end of the series. We're now talking about things that we can actually read in English. And I would like to focus today on what I call the changing role of manuscripts. You know, sometimes we see all this stuff and we study about it. We don't stop to think of what it really means. So that's what we're going to focus on today. And well, maybe if we have enough time, we'll even get some real examples of some of this. With the invention of printing, scholars of the Bible in various languages set forth the promise of a standardized text that everyone could study and read for themselves. Now, we talked about this before, but let's just review it. What's going on here? What's going on here is when you figure out how to print something and you go chunk and you got a page and then you go chunk again and you got exactly the same page more or less, so you didn't catch a fly somewhere in there in the middle there or something like that. But basically you got the same stuff. And the idea was people thought, wow, you know, almost immediately they were going, well, okay, we don't have to copy things by hand anymore. Everybody can have one just the same. And it was an exciting prospect, so that my Bible will be the same as yours, and your Bible will be the same as somebody else's. We'll all have the same version. But unfortunately, they discovered very quickly that printers make mistakes just as copyists used to make mistakes. And now everybody has the same mistake. Well, more than that, however, different scholars putting together different texts that were available to them translated the Bible in different ways, giving different versions. And that's what we have here on the table in front of you. One of the facsimile of the original King James, the Great Bible, the Bishop's Bible, you can see them over here. And you can see that, yeah, the big mass of the material is very similar. There's not that much different. But there are significant differences, and those significant differences are enough to go to war over. But even the famous King James came out with differences in printings and copies that required many corrections. As manuscripts and versions began to compete for people's attention, the question was raised, which one of these is the most reliable? That in turn led to the question, on what are they based? From what documents were they translated? I mean, how would you decide if you had these ancient documents in front of you? Now, we've sort of gotten used to the idea of having different versions, different translations we can look at. But if you had these things sitting out in front of you, looking at the bishops and looking at the King James, and they look pretty much the same. I mean, how do you decide? Do I follow the bishops' committee or do I follow the King James committee? Well, you know what the Catholic Church, I mean, we'll talk about this again a little bit later, but the Catholic Church solved this problem simply. They just, at the Council of Trent in 1454, I think it was, just said, this version of Jerome's Vulgate, that's the official Bible, that's it. Problem solved. So, in essence, this issue about which is the true Bible and all these different translations and versions and so forth became a Protestant exercise. The Catholics really weren't interested, particularly. Now, they get involved a little bit later, but it wasn't really a Catholic exercise. So, then it was not long before people began to understand that the older manuscripts would be closer to the original, presumably. And you know what? If we do enough searching, we might even find some of those original manuscripts written by Paul or Peter or James or somebody like that. And so there were these people who flooded through the Middle East looking for manuscripts. And we'll talk about some of their stories in a few minutes. But you notice in this process that a subtle but very important progression was taking place. One, before the entrance of printing, manuscripts were originally the only Bibles which people had available to them. If you wanted to read the Bible, you had to find someone who could afford one or a church that could afford one. You had to sit down and you read it not in a printed form, but in somebody's handwriting that was written on paper or vellum or whatever. Those were the only Bibles that were available. So manuscripts were Bibles. Then, a little bit later, as printing became more widespread and people began to compare different versions, manuscripts were regarded as a basis for the Bible. So those handwritten versions, that's what we copied. And now, from those manuscripts, we have our Bible. See? Now we have Bibles. If you have a Bible now, it has to be printed. And I want mine to say the same thing that yours says. And you want yours to be compared with Cousin Joe's. And, you know, they got to be the same. But we recognize that all of these came from the manuscripts. But for a little while, the manuscripts were almost forgotten because now we have printed Bibles. But then as people's thinking began to expand, and I don't know what happens to people's thinking, as they began to think about all these issues, they recognized that the late manuscripts, which these printings were based on, and most of these translations, therefore, were based on, were maybe not reliable. Maybe we need to go back and find earlier manuscripts. What if we could find some really early manuscripts, maybe some autographs? You know, autograph is the technical name for a manuscript that's written by the original author. That's what that means. Now, we know today that it's very unlikely. Well, we don't have any autographs. We don't have any books as originally written by the original authors. None. Zero. Zilch. And I doubt that we will ever find any of the original autographs. Very unlikely. But, you know, there was that dream that they had for a while. You know, if we go in there, we go out to the Middle East, we start exploring, maybe we'll find some of those really ancient documents. So, and in the process, of course, they started raising, well, what if we find some of those ancient manuscripts? Will they be different than the ones, those, if they're Greek or they're Hebrew or they're Aramaic or they're whatever, will they be different than the ones that were used to translate our English Bibles that we now read? And if they're different, what are we going to do about it? Who are we going to trust here? And scholars began to start raising some real serious questions. Then in the 19th and 20th centuries, the science of archaeology began to blossom. Rising with it were romantics such as Konstantin von Tischendorf, and we'll talk quite a bit more about him in a moment, a Russian count who traveled around the world searching for manuscripts in remote places. I mean, and this guy had a nose on him like you wouldn't believe. He could sniff out manuscripts. He would go to monasteries and he would make friends with the people there, and he'd be searching around and, you know, what are you hiding in your cupboards? And, you know, he was quite a guy. I mean, his story is fascinating. We'll read some little pieces of it here in a moment. But this guy traveled around the world, and that's what he did, and he could afford to, because he was a count. So as older and older manuscripts were found, it was recognized that the late manuscripts, on which the King James Version and others like it were based, were probably not the most reliable sources. You know, what do you do when someone starts shaking your faith in the Bible that you read every day? It should be recognized that the search for ancient manuscripts was a distinctly Protestant effort, and I mentioned this a moment ago. The Roman Catholic Church had already declared that the Vulgate, that is the Latin translation, as translated by Jerome and as preserved in Rome, was the official Bible. Now, we'll translate it for you in English if you really need it, and you can read it in English if you really want to, but the official Bible is the Latin Vulgate. That's the one that's official. We don't care if it came from the Greek. We don't care if it came from the Hebrew. The church has spoken, and the Latin is now the official Bible. That's the way they solved the problem. But Protestants were searching for Greek and Hebrew manuscripts that went back to the days of Jerome or maybe before the days of Jerome. What if you found a manuscript that was before the days of Jerome and you say, look, Jerome got it wrong here. Then what do you do? Well, in 1844, Constantine von Tischendorf traveled around the Middle East looking for monasteries and ancient churches that might have ancient documents hidden away. He went to the monastery, this is one famous story, he went to the monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai. It was called St. Catherine's Monastery, having been established by Constantine's mother back in the 4th century. Now, think about the situation in 1844. How would you get to Mount Sinai?
I didn't even know where it was,
did they? We still don't know for sure where it is today, but at least this one that they called. Yeah, you ride a horse, or you ride a camel, or you walk. Those are the only ways to get there. I mean, it wasn't easy to go searching around like this. So, you know, today there's a regular stream of people visiting the monastery there and climbing up the steps. You know, one monk spent his entire useful life carving steps in that mountain so that you could walk up there to the top of Mount Sinai, which probably isn't the real Mount Sinai, but that's what he did. That was his contribution to mankind. And there's hotels and tourists coming and going. But in Tischendorf's day, I'm sure when he arrived, it was a great hoopla because there's somebody who came to visit us. Well, lo and behold, it was the colder time of year. It doesn't get really cold there, but it was a little bit cool. So they gave him a room, and here he is in the evening, and it's a little bit cold, and he's getting ready to go to bed, and in comes this monk. He says, "Here, let me make a fire for you." And he has the wood set out like this, and he's taking something, and he's using it to start the fire, and Tischendorf looks, and these are ancient papyri with stuff written on them, and the guy is using it for kindling. And he said, "Stop!" You know, you could just see Tischendorf. "Stop! Hold it! Wait! What are you doing there?" Whereupon the guy announced to him that he'd already done this. He'd already used two basketfuls of these pages to start fires with. Well, Tischendorf managed on that occasion to save about 43 pages of that ancient papyrus and persuaded them to use something else for kindling. 9 years later, that was in 1844, that's a fairly important year for Adventists. 9 years later, in 1853, when he was able to go back to Sinai, he could not convince them to give or sell any of their manuscripts. After his previous visit, they realized that those documents might be worth something. You know, first time they're throwing it away, they're building fires with it, and next time he comes back and, "No way, you know, this stuff might be worth something." Well, finally, 6 years later, in 1859, he went back as an official representative of Tsar Alexander II and negotiated with the monks at Mount Sinai to recover, and it's a long story that goes behind this. They had some problems, and they were trying to resolve these problems, and they were hoping that the Tsar would help them, etc. But he managed to recover a codex, which came to be known as the Codex Sinaiticus, containing a large portion of the Old Testament, the Apocrypha, the entire New Testament, as well as a couple of books that were not previously available in Greek, known as the Epistle of Barnabas and the Shepherd of Hermes. Now, imagine arriving there, and what kind of a Bible? Now, let's keep this straight in our mind. What kind of a Bible would this be? What language would it be written? Now, we often think that this manuscript that he found, the Codex Sinaiticus, is all in Greek, because that's what people were using in the 4th century, Greek. Almost no one was still reading Hebrew. So it was all in Greek. So what the Old Testament would be what? What do we call the Old Testament in Greek? The Septuagint. However, by that, if you remember the things we studied in the past, by this time in history, was it the original Septuagint? Probably, well, not only copies of copies, but it probably wasn't the original Septuagint as translated by the Septuagint Committee, because we've already had Origen, we've had Eusebius, and especially Origen. Remember that up to eight volume thing that he did, and people came along and said, well, Origen's version is better than the Septuagint, so let's use that fifth column that he wrote in his book, and we'll call that the Septuagint. So it probably wasn't one of those, it probably really wasn't the original Septuagint. We probably have in the Sinaiticus, and we're going to talk about the Vaticanus in a few minutes. And those, remember Constantine, when he first became a Christian, said, I want 50 copies of the official Bible in Greek made for my empire. And these two famous documents, the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus, were probably two of those 50 that were originally made by Constantine, all in Greek. So, very important documents. But they're not all the way back. There's still, got a mic there? Come on down. There's still, you know, we're now talking 4th century, and that's back a long ways, because the King James that they had at this point in time was based on documents from the 10th through the 14th centuries. Yes.
I've been reading Edersheim, and this LXX is referred to, and I had no idea what it meant. That is the
Septuagint.
The Septuagint,
yes.
In Greek.
Okay, LXX, this LXX you see here is the Latin for 70. You recognize the Roman numerals. 70 comes from in Greek, 70 is Septuagint. And it comes from the original story that happened about 200 years before Christ, in which, according to a certain letter that's been preserved, probably not accurate, but according to this letter, 70 scholars were invited by King Ptolemy of those days to come down from among the Jews over in Jerusalem somewhere, come down and translate the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek so he could have it in his library. So that's the story. That's how the Greek Old Testament, In the Old Testament as translated into Greek, is referred to in all scholarly documents by this expression.
It's called the LXX, but yeah. in a word, it's called the Septuagint.
Yeah, it's called a Septuagint. So it's funny. We have a Latin number and a Greek name for what used to be a Hebrew manuscript.
Jim?
Yeah.
Jim. Wasn't the legend that they put these translators, 70 of them, into 70 booths, and they came out with this all the same?
The legend is, if you read the legend, is that 70 translators came down, and they were divided up into 35 teams of two people in each team, and then they were put, now, in some people say they were put into caves, others say they were put into cubicles. And all 70 of these, well, the 35 teams now, and some say it was really not 70, it was 72, so there were 36 teams, well, plus or minus, doesn't matter. That after 70 days, they came out of those cubicles, and every one of these teams came up with a translation which is exactly the same, and you all recognize that that's impossible, but that's the story, and that's proof that it was a miraculous translation, blessed by God, and that's where the Septuagint story comes from. Go ahead, Don, you were next, and then...
Is the Codex from Leningrad the same as these others, or are they believed to be leftovers from the original?
Okay, I believe you're talking about the one that Jim shows us up here, or which Codex are you talking about?
The one that they have in Leningrad.
Okay, the one that's in Leningrad, if I'm reading you correctly, is in Hebrew. It's not this. That's the oldest Hebrew version which we had before the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. Now it's still 9th, 10th century kind of stuff, okay? That's Hebrew. The other ancient Hebrew document is in Stuttgart. So there's one in Stuttgart, one in Leningrad. But then, we go back 10 centuries when we come to the Dead Sea Scrolls. See, okay? Now, let me just interrupt for a second. I have my very beat up Greek Bible here I'm going to pass around for you all to look at, because we're going to talk about a little bit about the implications of this. I just want you to look at it. I want you to notice two things as you look through here. The Greek T text is this stuff at the top here, and then there's all this funny little stuff at the bottom. And just look at it, and we'll talk about what the, if we don't get to it today, we'll talk about it next week. But anyway, try to preserve my Greek New Testament there. It hasn't had any use, as you can see. Go ahead.
Well, what were all these changes that they were all so worried about? And have the Dead Sea Scrolls shown that they were what mistakes were and what weren't?
Okay.
Is that too idealistic?
No. If nobody has done it yet, and no one has checked it out yet, who knows what mistakes there might be in there? That was the point. That was the point back in those days. Until you have some manuscripts in hand that show differences, you don't know. I mean, that was their fee. I mean, here we have this Bible that's being printed for us, but how do we know? We haven't seen any of these ancient documents.
Well, then they might have some Catholic Church things in them.
Who knows, you know? Yeah.
So everybody hollers about the clear word, and maybe they were something like the clear word.
Who knows? You see, if you don't have anything to compare it with...
Well, that's why the Dead Sea Scrolls kind of help.
Okay, well, the Dead Sea Scrolls are interesting because, remember, the Dead Sea Scrolls applies only to the Old Testament.
Yes, that's true.
Because it was materials that was preserved before, around about the time of Jesus, and the documents were all the Old Testament. So the Dead Sea Scrolls doesn't help us at all with the New Testament.
That's true, yeah.
But what the New Testament stuff you need to look at is what's coming in that book right there. Okay? So finally, Tischendorf manages to get his Sinaiticus. It has this Old Testament Greek, it has the New Testament Greek in the original language, and it has some of these extra books in it, all in one big volume. It has the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is included in there. All of that's in this book we call the Codex Sinaiticus. And the expression Codex is just a technical Greek name, or actually Latin name, for a book as opposed to a scroll. Okay? Well, just to talk about the Codex Sinaiticus a bit more, it was taken to Russia and kept there for a period of time, and after the Communist Revolution, they said, we have no use for this biblical document. They needed cash, and they agreed to sell it to the British Museum for a sizable sum of money. In those days, it was like $150,000. Can you imagine what it would be worth today? And they actually had a campaign around England. They asked kids, even in schools, to raise money so they could buy this. And Dr. Maxwell remembers as a kid them coming around, please give this money so we can buy this manuscript from the Russians. Go ahead.
I just want to back up a little. I'm a little hazy on this. You said when the 70 were invited by Ptolemy to come down, where was this, to Rome or to Alexandria?
Alexandria.
Well, there was a tremendous amount of stuff lost in that big fire. Some of that could have been there, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the Alexandria, what was in... I mean, if you talk about something that would be worth billions and billions of dollars today, if we could recover what was in Alexander's library there, the Alexandrian, not Alexander, but the Alexandrian library, oh man. He set out, this was his goal, I don't know how far he got, but his goal was to have, either in the original language or in a language which he could read, a copy of everything that had ever been written. Can you imagine, in Alexander's day, 200 years before Christ, a copy of everything that had ever been written in one library? Yeah. That'll make you salivate if you think about ancient things. Well, so here we have a document in the New Testament in the original Greek, probably one of the 50 that were copied by Constantine for Constantine's benefit, and probably very close to the Greek, which Jerome himself used for the translation of the Vulgate. Scholars had moved back 6 centuries from what was previously available. Now, I don't know whether this worried the Catholics, but you know, what do you do now when you've got the original Greek, at least the Greek, from which Jerome translated, and, you know, if you keep going back, if you get manuscripts further back, people are going to say, well, now, just a minute, you know, did Jerome do a good job? You start challenging even the Vulgate. Well, at least one other very important document, similar to the Codex Sinaiticus, was found at the Vatican. It was first, quote, discovered, and notice quotation marks there, at the Vatican during a library inventory taken in 1475. It was also a 4th century Greek uncial, and I already told you that the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus were probably both, you know, sister documents from that 50 that Constantine asked to be produced. It was, and both of them are Greek uncials. Do you understand what uncial means? Uncial is a word that comes from the Greek word for one, and I don't know exactly how it got this, but the original notion is that these letters are 1 inch high. That's how it gets the name one. They really weren't, but they're capital letters written in a very square style, and there are a number of documents written in that kind of style. And actually, I might be able, probably not. I was going to show you some, but not sure if I have any, but I can find them later. There are a number of Greek manuscripts originally written like that, and they were run straight through, no punctuation, everything in capital letters, and a lot of abbreviations. So the word God, instead of spelled with a TH, you know, the theta, EOS, they would just do THS, and they put a little line over it. So this is an abbreviation. So they saved space on the page. And lots of abbreviations like that. And maybe I can illustrate that here in a moment. I'll have my program load up, and you'll see what we're talking about. So, the Codex Vaticanus in the Vatican includes the Old Testament in Greek, otherwise remember known as the Septuagint, the New Testament in Greek, and the Apocrypha, but is missing Genesis 46, I don't know why, 30 chapters out of Psalms, and the entire portion of the New Testament after Hebrews 9:14. It is officially named the B manuscript. So if you look in that volume that's going around, my Greek thing there, and you look at that, all those funny little marks at the bottom, which is called the apparatus. If you look carefully there, you will see fairly often that the capital letter B, and that means that there's a variation from this Vatican document. And if you know the Hebrew letter Aleph, you know, which is written kind of like an X with a couple little extra side tails on it, you see Aleph written fairly often in that apparatus, and that means that there's a variation of the script that's in the page up above there. There's a variation of that script found in the Codex Sinaiticus that's a little different than what's in the text, and that's why these special every document has to have a letter like this so they can cram it in that little apparatus at the bottom. Well, several other famous manuscripts were also discovered about the same time and should be mentioned. Codex Alexandrinus was designated A. It comes from the 5th century, so about 100 years later than the Vaticanus and the Sinaiticus. It was donated to Charles I, King of England, by the Patriarch of Constantinople in 1627. It is now found in the British Museum. Like the two previous manuscripts, it is entirely in Greek. It contains the entire Old Testament and substantial portions of the New Testament. But you're noticing, I hope, as we go along, that all of these major documents that we're talking about, these huge codices, are all in what language? Greek. We don't have any Hebrew. We don't have any Aramaic. And you heard us mention a moment ago that the oldest documents in Hebrew, before we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, were about the 10th century, or after the 10th century. Why is that? Remember, the Jewish people had this custom that when a document got old, and because they didn't have very good ink in those days, some of the ink would dry out and maybe smudge or something, and you were not allowed to touch the writing at any time. It was forbidden to touch the writing because you would just hasten the deterioration process. When a document got old, then someone would sit down and very carefully copy it, and then you had to destroy and burn the previous document. That's why there's almost no ancient Hebrew manuscripts surviving. Of course, remember that the Masoretes developed this very, very sophisticated system for making very careful copies. So fortunately, down through all those hundreds of years, the copies were very carefully done. But the Codex Alexandrinus, now that would be in Hebrew, remember. We're talking about the Old Testament. We're talking about copies made in Hebrew. But the Codex Alexandrinus illustrates something that became troublesome to scholars. In some places, the translation seems to be excellent, very thoughtfully, very carefully done. It's quality alongside the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus. But in other places, it is very slipshod, almost as if the translator or translators was or were drunk when doing the work. So now we've got another problem. Here you've got documents, and you read along and you say, well, that part looks pretty good, but I don't like this part over here. I wonder what happened down here. Okay, this part looks okay, but we got another problem over here, you know? And these are documents we're supposed to be using to decide what are God's words. Another famous manuscript which came to light is named the Codex Ephraimi. It was also written in the 5th century, but it has a very interesting history. In the 12th century, now, the document is already 700 years old, notice. Someone scraped off the writing of the biblical text and over it wrote sermons and treatises from a 4th century Syriac author by the name of Ephraimi. So what you have here is you've got Greek. The Greek has been scraped off of the paper, the papyrus, and someone has written more or less in between the lines, mostly, where the Greek has been scraped off in a script that looks a lot like Arabic, you know, that kind of writing backwards kind of stuff. So that Syriac is written more or less in between the lines of where the Greek used to be. So there's a technical name for that. It's called a palimpsest. That's a Greek word which means something has been erased and something else has been written on top of it. It is therefore called the Codex Ephraimi rewritten, or the Greek and the Latin have other words, but that's fine. So it's a rewritten document. Fortunately, after finding this manuscript, Tischendorf, and he's our famous guy again, he found this manuscript. He spent years, literally, off and on, carefully going through, scraping off the Syriac. And he figured out how to use even chemical reagents and so forth to get the original Greek to show up again. So it's fairly readable, actually, believe it or not. A lot of people believe that by the time he finished with this, his vision had really deteriorated. And a lot of people think it was because he spent so much time trying to figure out this Codex Ephraimi. Another very interesting ancient document is called the Codex Cambridgiensis, after Cambridge. Oh boy, I see I got a misspelling here. Hold on a second. It's supposed to be an R in Cambridge there. After Cambridge University, or the Codex Bezi, because it's designated by the letter D. It was given to the University of Cambridge by Theodore Beza, the reformer, in 1581. We mentioned his name briefly when we were talking about the Reformation. It is a bilingual manuscript in two columns, Greek and Latin, side by side. It contains the four Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles. Another manuscript, which probably was meant to go along with it, seems to be is called the Codex Claromontanus. It is also in bilingual columns, but it contains the epistles of Paul, including Hebrews.
Ken?
Yeah. Jim.
On that, you mentioned Codex Bezi. I have a New Testament done by Johannes Graeber. In fact, maybe you also have a copy of it. And if you read the introduction, he you see, the Codex Bezi is not a very good manuscript because there's so many gaps. But this guy, Graeber, used his wife, who was a spiritualist, to help fill in the gaps.
Okay. Well, that's one way to do it. That's almost like the Spiritist Bible, where you go and rewrite the New Testament according to the spirits. Well, interestingly enough, the Codex Bezi has a 20% longer version of the Acts of the Apostles. Have any of you read that? So there's lots of interesting stuff in these ancient documents we don't know about. It's 20% longer than the one which we have. Scholars have struggled to try to figure out where those additional verses of material came from. In the Codex Bezi, there's a great deal of emphasis on the role of, and this is the extra verses, there's a lot of emphasis on the role of the Holy Spirit, which we would say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, but there's also a lot of intense anti-Semitism. That's probably not such a good idea. So what have we learned from all these ancient manuscripts? We realize that there was much more variation in the early readings from these ancient manuscripts than was at first thought. You see, when all we had was the relatively modern copies made in Europe, what's called the Textus Receptus, which a lot of people still think is the Holy Grail. It isn't. But we had almost all of the copies in Western Europe back in those days were pretty accurately copied from that same one tradition. So now, as they're going back into the Middle East, they're finding these other documents, some in Italy, some in Constantinople, others over in well, we talked about Sinai, others in the Middle East, so forth, and people like Tischendorf are going all over the world trying to find these things, and they're discovering that some of these are significantly different. Now, before some of you panic and say, whoa, you know, do we have any reliable evidence for our scriptures? The differences, although they are many, are relatively inconsequential when it comes down to actually understanding the material. It doesn't change our understanding of scripture. That's the important thing, okay? So with that in mind, let's go on to talk. So in the 19th and 20th centuries, after this kind of stuff has been mulling around in people's minds for a while, people discovered various locations in the Middle East where entire libraries of documents were stored. A number of ancient papyri were found in Egypt. Two famous, and I might add very wealthy, document collectors have entire collections named after them. First, there's the Chester Beatty papyri, including P46, which is a manuscript which includes most of Paul's letters and was written around AD 200. That is our earliest manuscript of Paul's letters. So we actually have copies of Paul's letters now in Greek, written on fragile papyrus, but within 120 or 130 years of the time when Paul wrote. Now I'm going to show you just real quickly in modern type that you can more or less understand what some of that looked like. Okay. Now, I'm just going to point out a few things as you look here. This is an actual transcription of, in modern Greek, of this document where the Paul's letters, of Paul's letters from around 200 A.D., and I mentioned about the name of God. Okay, here's the name of God. You see my cursor right at the bottom there? You see the theta, the TH, and there is a U right there. Now that would mean it's the name of God, TH. It would normally be THEOU. It's one of the forms, the genitive form of the noun here, but to save space on the page, they leave out the EO and they just put a line over the top. See the line up there? And yeah, I won't go to it. Here's another example of the name of God, THU. They abbreviated other words too. Let me see if I can find any others here. And you see, at the bottom of the page, it says, leaf one recto. That means page one, the front side, and then if you go to the bottom of the next page, it'll say leaf two, recto, and it goes on. I guess apparently these were just written on one side. Okay, here's another example. You see, can you all see where my cursor is? You see this, do you know this Greek letter right there? Chi, that's the Greek, yeah, the statistician should know that letter. They use that all the time. That's the letter CH. It's all one letter in Greek. And what letter is this? Right next to it? That's there's two forms of the Greek letter for S, sigma. One goes like this. That's the sigma you use if you're in the middle of a word. And the other looks almost like our S, and that's if your S comes at the end of the word. Okay? So, what do you suppose the abbreviation with CHS would refer to? Of course. This is the name of Christ. Right there, that's the way it would be written. That's the way Paul originally wrote it, probably, or not Paul himself, probably his scribe originally wrote it. And the purpose would be, why would they do that? Why would they abbreviate like that? Yeah, save space. Remember, these documents were written probably on vellum, which is the skins, especially treated skins of unborn animals. It was expensive writing material. You didn't just, you know, scratch on or scribble on a piece of paper. Nothing like that. Jim?
I don't know. If you were talking about those large letter uncials that were all run together, and
yeah.
maybe you're going to do it, but if you like, you take the word God is nowhere or God is here. But if you read all those letters together, yeah. And if you don't understand the context,
yep.
But also if you have that word, abbreviation there for Christ or for God, mm-hmm. You know what, you don't have to determine where the how to translate it, because that stands out on the page, seems to me.
Yeah. Here's another example. You see, here's the name of God. Here's two more examples of the name of God. Theon, this would be the I got a blank for the Greek form. Anyway, this is the form of the Greek, the name God, if it's an object as opposed to a subject. And here's the name of God as a subject. You see, THS. So THEO are left out in the middle. So this would be God as the name of referring to God as a person, as a subject, and this would be the name of God as an object. And you notice they did the same thing to save space, even with pronouns. A pronoun, here's a PROS is a pronoun. Pros means toward or in front of something. But they left out the S and put a line over it because, again, it saves a little bit of space on the page. So it just gives you a little idea there of what we're talking about here and some of the challenges. And like Jim says, a lot of these, not all of them, but many of these documents were written in uncials where there's no, they didn't even, to save space, there wasn't any break between words. There was no break between sentences. It's just continuous. And you have to figure out, okay, where are the words break? Where's the sentences break? You have to decide that as you read. So that document you just looked at is a transcription of the earliest manuscript of Paul's letters. Chester Babaire's collection also includes P52, the oldest copy of any portion of the New Testament. Let me just show you that real quick here. Remember mine, I'm just going to show you transcriptions of these things. I can't show you pictures of the original. And you notice, what does this entire document include? John 18, 31 to 33, and 37 to 35, 38. That's all the entire document. That's all there is to it. There it is. See? And here, see if it shows you here. I don't know why apparently they filled in the portions that are missing here. Yeah, they did. Huh. Didn't realize that. Okay. This particular document, which is the oldest document we have for any, let me put that another way. The closest document we have to any biblical autograph. This document dates to around 125 AD. John wrote it about somewhere between 90 and 100 AD. So this document, the original thing, is no more than 35 years old, maximum. I mean, older from the original. See, you go to the Old Testament, and we're talking 1,000 years between the oldest thing we have and the original stuff that was written. See, here we have one that's within 35 years. And it's a piece that's about that big, about 2.5 by 3 inches, something like that. And on one side is John 18, 31 to 34, I think it is. And on the other side is John 37 and 38, I guess it is.
Ken.
And, yeah.
Does that go by another name of the John Rylands papyri? Isn't that one for?
I think you're right.
Is
yeah.
So
in order to make it so you can read it, they've put in the rest of the context. You see, the part here that's not in brackets is what's actually in the document. And starting here with the brackets, all this stuff is missing. Till you go on to the next page, you see it says verso, that means turn the page. And here's what's at the top of the next page down to here. And then all this, of course, is missing. So it's this piece on the back. Hold on here. The back side of the little tiny document has that much right there. And the front side of the document has that right there. And that's all we have. But now you say, well, okay, so what difference does a little tiny piece like that make? Well, believe it or not, a little tiny piece like that can have a very significant impact in some cases. This document can be dated to around 125 AD. I already told you that. A lot of people, before this little piece was found, were claiming the Gospel of John has too much stuff that sounds too mature, too sophisticated to have ever been written by John himself. It was probably written somewhere near the end of the 2nd century AD. That was the common belief of scholars until all of a sudden this little piece shows up. And what do you do when they're saying it's not written until 200 AD, and here you got a little piece that dates to 125 AD? You got to change your theories, right? One of those paradigm shifts. Got a problem here, folks. Yeah, Gordon. Hold on. Here comes the mic.
Can you tell us how they know it's from 125?
There's two ways that they date these documents. One is by the kind of letters that people use and the way they write. That's part of it. But they also use carbon 14. And you just takes a tiny little piece. It was something that's, you know, what is that? 2000 years ago, carbon 14 can date pretty accurately. And that kind of, well, we got the carbon 14 guy here for us. You want to tell us how much variation there is in carbon 14 that's, what is that, 2,000 years old? Pretty good. Yeah, the dating's pretty good at that time period. Yeah, up to about 4,000, as Dr. Rose says, dating by carbon 14 is pretty reliable. Okay. There's also another collection known as the Bodmer Papyri. It includes P66, and I could show that if we had enough time, but we're running out of time. Another portion of John dating from around AD 200. P72, which is the earliest, and of course you could guess that these P's, what do you suppose that refers to? Parts. No, actually it's papyrus. A papyrus document, and they're numbered then according to the order, basically the order in which they were found. So P refers to a papyrus document. Which is earliest, P72, which is the earliest known text of Jude and 2 Peter, probably from the 3rd century, and P75, our earliest manuscript of the Gospel of Luke, dating from somewhere around the end of the 2nd century. But it was not only ancient biblical manuscripts that were being found. A number of archaeological digs took place and entire libraries of manuscripts and other materials, particularly from Egypt, proved to be very helpful. At a site called Oxyrhynchus, near the Nile River, they found what turned out to be a dump with tens of thousands of papyri containing a wide assortment of materials from the 1st through the 7th century. Scholars have been working on these documents for the last 100 years. In fact, it's more than 100 years now. They still haven't had a chance to analyze and translate all of these documents. Tens of thousands of them. They include business transactions, letters, contracts, Greco-Roman philosophical materials, and also scraps of scriptural texts and apocryphal writings, even a portion of the Gospel of Thomas, which has become developed some notoriety in recent years. Then in 1945, a small library of documents was found in a place known as Chenobaskian in Egypt, which was very quickly renamed Nag Hammadi. There were 49 Gnostic writings in Coptic. They were all written in the Coptic language, which is the ancient Egyptian language. They're written in the 3rd or 4th century. It was from among these documents that we get our oldest version, complete version, of the Gospel of Thomas. So there have not been nearly as many ancient Hebrew documents found. Very few people were able to read, copy, and understand the ancient Hebrew. One important document was between you and I, Gordon, we still didn't catch all the mistakes in here, was found in 1903 in Egypt, known as the Nash Papyrus. It is a tiny fragment, but it contains the Shema Yisrael, the very famous passage from Deuteronomy 6:4, and you know that passage. It says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." And just as the Catholics would wear a cross around their necks, if the Jews had one thing that they would take as their symbol, it would be this verse. But of course, the most important modern find of all was the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were found in 1947 and came from the Essene community in the Wadi Qumran near the Dead Sea. We now know that the Essene community had enough biblical material that one could put together portions of almost every book of the Old Testament. In fact, large portions of almost every book of the Old Testament. The crown jewel of the Qumran collection was an entire, beautifully preserved scroll of the book of Isaiah. And if some of you thought that you would go down to San Diego and get a look at that scroll, forget it. It will never leave Israel. that scroll is preserved, and if you ever go to Israel, absolutely you must go and see it. It is preserved in a special bomb-proof shelter that is considered to be safe even if it were hit by a nuclear weapon. I mean, it is protected down underneath there, and you can walk down and around in a big circle, and it's preserved behind, I think, 3 inches or something of plexiglass. You know, there like this, and behind it is the document. But you can read it. It's very easily visible, and you can walk around and read the entire, if you can read Hebrew, you can walk around and read the entire book of Isaiah. And once again, it's very interesting because here's a document 150 to 200 years before Christ, at a time when scholars believed at that point in time that Isaiah wasn't written by one author. It was written by three authors. There's the first Isaiah, there's second Isaiah, there's third Isaiah, all broken up. And third Isaiah particularly wasn't written until around 200 B.C. Well, what do you do? Here's a document that's almost at 200 B.C. and it's complete. There's not even the slightest hint of any 1, 2, or 3 Isaiah. What does that do to your thinking about documents? So these are just a few of the things that scholars have to struggle with when they look at these ancient documents. Well, next time we'll look at the challenges of the most scientific thing that occurs in the biblical world, textual criticism. How do scholars, looking at all these documents, try to piece them together and figure out what we can trust, what is reliable, what is really a part of our Bible? Well, as you can imagine, the discovery of all those documents over the years stimulated a renewed interest in the ancient works and the question of which documents are the most reliable. Okay, we're pretty much out of time. Does anybody have a short question or whatever? We've covered quite a bit of material, but okay, let's pray. Our loving Father, we thank you for the wonderful gifts that you have given us to all of these ancient documents. We are so thankful to be able to turn to our Bibles, translated very well into language that we can understand and which is common in our day, and feel with confidence that we are reading your words. We look forward to the day when we'll be able to see in 3D living color the history of all these things and realize how you had to step in, I'm sure, on many occasions to preserve these key documents so that we would have a reliable record to depend upon in our day. We thank you once again. In Jesus' name, amen. And thank you all for coming.